more time.
I'm now. We're happy to introduce our next speaker. Shall we do this formally? So, John, what do you have to tell us?
What I have to tell you didn't exist 50 minutes ago. I wrote it this morning. I'm just going to barrel in, but I'm doing it like this because I'm using Walt's talk as a model, because I've just come back from 3 months working in India, and I travelled around. I've been to India and Sri Lanka quite a bit, and on previous occasions I felt a bit like Christian in Pilgrim's Progress. You know, he carries that terrible knapsack of stuff. And I always used to go with books and paper. Because, you know, sort of insecurity, I wanted to have my sources with me to prepare what I was going to say. Well, this time, it just seems to me a postmodern irony that I took everything I needed on something I could swallow. And on this, I must have about 20 PowerPoint presentations, any one of which might have, you know, with a bit of, you know, borrow a laptop, jiggle it about, do the business. No, I was at a conference where it was in a quite remote place, and we'd taken a long time to get there, two flights, and the facilities were tremendous, and we gave our talks, and one very eminent philosopher, scientist, president of the conference, had bought a laptop on which the talk he was going to give was, but something went wrong, and he couldn't use the laptop, and he said he couldn't give his talk. And I thought there a huge alarm bell rang there. I thought, no, this guy has got a problem. If he's got something to say, he can say it. And if the technical equipment goes wrong, well, then you do something else.
He's a philosopher.
I don't want to say who it is, because you all know this person.
But because normally the philosophers are the ones who are the most phobic about using...
This guy is...
They read that.
Yeah,
but the point is, I mean, you know, he's an international eminent figure. Now, that's not right. If he's got something to say, he can say it.
We all want to know that.
We
could
survive on
the guessing game.
Well,
we have access to other images.
Oh, no, I may be being unfair in the sense that, of course, if you have a PowerPoint presentation that has materials and... presentation resources which can't be done in any other way.
You can describe the Raphael painting.
That's right.
Or the
video. No, I agree. There are things. But then, yeah. You know, at least you keep going.
Yeah.
At least you keep going. And there's something cyborg-like about that. You know, so you take away his laptop and he goes... I threw away my... I really do feel that Pilgrim's Progress is a good analogy, because, you know, at one point the thing rolls off his back and he's liberated. Well, I threw away my laptop. I feel like an Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I've got a. Sorry.
Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a few things to say, and I think they'll take about 20-30 minutes, I would welcome it if people would just sort of give me a way to say 30 minutes have gone, and then I'll try and wind down in order to do what can be done in this, which strikes me as the ideal size for a conference. Because now we know each other personally. We've all given talks at these conferences where you look out on a sea of anonymous faces, you do your business with the PowerPoint, and you talk to a few people afterwards, and then somebody else does the same thing. Well, something gets done at places like this, but this gets something else done. So, I'm extremely glad and grateful to be here. I think it's an enormous privilege, an opportunity. And of course, you can imagine, having just spent 3 months working under Indian conditions, which I love and hate. I love to be in India, and I hate it too. The contrast here is just out of this world. The toilets, particularly. And
this is a major part of the Indian experience.
I think I'm extremely glad to have the opportunity to talk to you briefly, and my purpose in talking to you is to hear my own ideas, to get more in contact with what I think and feel, because you know I'm here on a mission, like we all are. I want to do things, I don't know what to do. And that's not a bad sign. I mean, it's the universal condition. And what the things I want to do is to help to change what I do, where I work, which is Warwick University in the UK, to increase something which I already do, which is to remind students that first-person data is real and legitimate, and to give them and myself something to do. So, just to say where I'm heading at the end of this talk, I want to just throw out a couple of ideas for projects, things that I can suggest to students. You know, why don't you try something like this, or do you want to explore that, and see what you think of them. But the talk is very roughly structured into past, present, and future, and I'll deal with the present first. I'm here. Still with my mind partly in Kandy in Sri Lanka, which was the last place I was about 3 weeks ago. Still, you know, with those sorts of ideas, those sorts of traditions, those sorts of ways of approaching intellectual and spiritual life active in my mind. And Walt's talk is a model for me, because I think one of the many things I took away from his talk was this notion that what we call religious experiences are universal. They might have common characteristics. We could study them like anthropologists study the beliefs of other cultures, but at the same time, you know, it's our culture and it's our minds. And we have responsibilities as teachers, those of us who do. And what sort of a space do you open up in front of your students by saying there's this sort of data and there's nothing else? And what sort of a space do you open up by saying these things are legitimate too? My personal position is that I started out in experimental psychology, for which I still have a huge amount of respect and interest, and I like good experimental work, but I've come for reasons that are untraceable to have a current agenda. I think Charles Sanders Peirce is the most important American thinker, perhaps of all time, but certainly of the 19th century. And I think Bergson is returning. You know, Bergson is back, and this time it's personal. I think William James's legacy has been betrayed. I think he's one of the greatest psychologists there's ever was, ever been. And the agenda that he set out has been selectively ignored. There's a huge lump of James that for some reason became invisible, and it's about time that it's back, and I just put out an advert for the fact that this year is the 100th anniversary of Creative Evolution, and there's a big conference for it. You're all invited to submit a paper, and you'll have fun. And lastly,
what are the dates?
June, July. It's probably August, September at Warwick, but go to the philosophy department at Warwick University and you'll find it eventually. They're being extraordinarily modest about it, but I think it's going to be a big event. And my belief is that with the renaissance of interest in Bergson, we will see the way open to a new metaphysics based upon Alfred North Whitehead and Merleau-Ponty. And that is my present project, you might say. That is what I'm trying to work on. And this is me filling in the sort of background to who I am, how I come to be talking here. And last thing I want to say is that I run a course. I teach at Warwick University for 2 years. I teach conventional cognitive science, happy to do it, like it, and I like getting students interested in the notion of an experimental approach to the mind. And there's lots of good stuff there. But in the third year, I run a course called Mind in Context, in which I deal with all sorts of things, Indian philosophy and Buddhism in particular, phenomenology, Bergson. And in the student feedback, I quite often encounter a very interesting issue, which is anger. The students are angry, and the reason they're angry, one of them said, why have I had to wait 3 years to get what I came to do originally? No, this is why I came to do psychology. What I heard in your course, this is not me just puffing myself up, I'm in my course is not right for everyone. Some people leave it, there's nothing here, I want hard experimental data. Right. But I just think that has to mean something. We've got a whole bunch of students going through British universities with a lot of anger inside them, saying, why haven't I got what I wanted? And the response from the system is, you made a mistake. You picked the wrong degree. No, I think they picked the right degree, but they just were failed. So that's my agenda. That's where I want to end up. How can we put a few projects into the arena that will meet those needs? Now, very quickly, into the past. We underestimate, I think, one of the things that I've got from reading Mort's materials on postmodernism is that we don't realize we don't realize how much we get from the cultural myths that we tell ourselves. We learn them as history and think, that's it, that's just me learning facts. I think, for example, one of the books I get my students to read is The Passion of the Western Mind by Thomas. And it's a brilliant book. And just remind them, that we've got a huge cultural engine with its momentum in the West. And, if you just read it as history, you're just learning dates and places, but it comes with you. It conditions everything you think and feel and notice and do. And going to India is such a breath of fresh air, because here you have a culture where the myth we tell ourselves in the West, that there were the dark ages, there was top-down religious oppression, then heroic scientists broke through, defeated religion, and we moved up into the broad sunlit uplands of rational acquaintance with our own condition. It just doesn't play in India. Of course, India is perfectly at home with Western intellectual culture, can handle it very well. But here you have a culture, and in China too, where I've also worked, you have a culture where this notion of science versus religion is just nonsense. And I realise within this audience, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know already. I'm just reminding you of things. And you know, in the Western myth, at all levels, it had never struck me until the conference in Delhi I was at a month ago. The Western, in the West, consciousness is a curse. God says, "Don't eat that. You eat it, right? You will be conscious as a punishment." And in the Vedic hymns, the hymn to Agni, the one of the multiple creation myths that are on offer in Vedic philosophy, the world making act, the Godhead, in as much as there is one, one has to be careful of putting Western terms onto Indian thought. But the first act is an act of self, a decision to be conscious. I think that's the way I would put it. That from chaos, it isn't that God intervened and formed out of chaos the day from the night, the waters from the earth, but that somehow a decision was taken to know the self. And it's fundamentally positive, because, you know, without that, you know, that's the answer to the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Because somehow a decision arose out of chaos to know what it is to know. It's an entirely different creation myth and gives consciousness something else to be. And although we think we live in the times when religious myths have been pushed back into the dark corners where they belong by the bright certainties of science, everyone knows that science actually received a great formative influence, impetus from religion, as any history of science tells you, Newton being a great example. And so with us comes this implicit notion that consciousness is somehow a difficulty, a curse, a complexification. And we're now in the postmodern era where people like John Gray in Britain writes that science is a myth of post-enlightenment cultures. The myth being that science is a normative language which defeats and somehow reduces all others. And you so often hear politicians saying, we must wait until it's scientifically proven that this is the case, just as one presumably would have heard 400 years ago.
Which we did.
You hear politicians, when cornered by journalists, taking refuge behind, you know, there is scientific evidence which says that this is the case. The classic example being environmental issues. Let's leave that one hanging as something we could come back to. I proceed on the basis of Richard Rorty's view that the fear that people have of psychology and science, particularly when it approaches consciousness as a first-person experience, is that everything will be reduced to what he calls a normative language, which is the same thing that Gray is criticizing, that there is one epistemological, ontological framework that will somehow absorb all others. And people, well, you know, why are people afraid of that? And I think it's because of an intuitive understanding that one view won't do. Now, Nietzsche said, the more views, the more truth, and I think that's right.
Have you got a source for that? Have you looking for that? Where he said that?
It's in the Genealogy of Morals.
Is it? Right.
I think it's either the Genealogy of Morals or Morals as a non... No, right and wrong is a non-moralistic proposition. I can find it. But he certainly for that.
Ages.
The more views, the more truth. There's no truth, just so. And I've completed my academic downfall by being enthusiastic about Jung. A sure sign, as far as my colleagues are concerned, my long-heralded mental demise. But I think Jung is important too, and I love his unease about what he calls the Nichts-Als attitude written into science. I mean, the point about science is to show that complex phenomena are nothing but, and when somebody like the great Kelvin, his tidal predictor, you know, that wonderful engine with pulleys and ropes and so on, and you turn the handle and it shows you how the water goes up and down at London Bridge, and so that, you know, that phenomenon at London Bridge is nothing but this, you know, the motion of the planets. And it's the old thing about reductionism. I mean, that will do. That's a pretty good demonstration of what science can do. But if we then approach all phenomena with that sort of epistemological gambit, we are in trouble. And I think Jung saw that very clearly. And he wrote far too much. I'm just so glad Jung didn't live any longer. Otherwise, he'd have more bookshelves full of things. But in amongst all that swill, there are a couple of really good pearls. And one of them is that he said, you know, numbers are not accurate enough. And there's something powerful there, because our image of what it is to know something precisely is to have the predictive power of something like quantum physics, which is hair-raisingly, wonderfully powerful. But if that's the only model of what it is to know something, we are, as William James and Alfred North Whitehead said, we're throwing away half of the evidence provided by human experience.
You know, Aristotle said in the Nicomachean Ethics that each subject matter should be treated with the precision that the subject permits, only with the degree of precision that the subject permits, which is very similar to that.
Right, thanks.
Yeah.
I should read more, but I've only got a certain amount of life, so. So that's really me closing the part of this presentation, which is about the past. I think we come training limiting clouds of bogus certainty about what it is to know. I think there's always enough ignorance to go around, and I think we give our students, and I'm concerned about the people I teach, and not in any patronizing way, but in the much better sense of, you know, I think academics should take a Hippocratic oath as well. You should not only try and do your best to teach, but you should try and do your best not to harm the students. And if you simply grind them through what the British Psychological Society wants them to be ground through, like a meat grinder, I think you're harming them. And I'm glad to see that things are changing. And I think this meeting is extremely timely for that reason, because I think things are getting better. We're now having qualitative methods for all their weaknesses. They need to be there to balance up the things that we are good at. You know, we really are good at well-controlled scientific experiments. Lovely. You know, shouldn't stop doing that. Shouldn't stop giving students the opportunity to learn, but don't tell them that that is somehow the normative language for all epistemological work. And with moving on to the last section of the talk and the future, I think part of the inheritance of this science defeats religion myth that we get in our mother's milk is a mistrust of certain. Science will only allow certain things to exist. And there's a mistrust of exceptional states, that, as Walt said, you know, as James noted, that the consciousness we allow to exist in our intellectual life is separated. What's wonderful, both the James thinnest of veils, wonderful writers.
Yeah.
Stranger to the full stop, but wonderful stuff nonetheless. There's a range of phenomena in consciousness, and we look down this tiny window because it suits the myth of the triumph of science. And so there's a mistrust of exceptional states and exceptional individuals, which is why, you know, going to India and meeting a culture where there is genuine critical respect for traditions which are richer than that. As I say, sort of completes my downfall as a British academic, because, you know, clearly he's a wacky New Age guy who likes to go to India and hang around with gurus. Well, no, it's not that way.
A hippie.
Yeah, wrinkly leftover from the 60s. And I'd just like to give you one example of something that happened to me. As most British academics do, I have to mark piles of essays. Next one, off we go, and I make a few notes, and I have a sheet with the student numbers. It's all anonymous. You don't have the names, just have the numbers. And this exercise turns your brain into mush, but you have to do it. So I was doing it, and here are these numbers, and student ID numbers at Waricast, seven figures. And
seven. You're lucky.
That's a lot of students.
That's for sure. And this number, is that a saying in the example with talking to Francisco and the girl walking by, this number comes to get me. Now, one number is very much the same as another. Any mathematician fit. But the seven digits were 0159177. There's no reason why there's every reason why that should have no meaning for you. But why did I notice that? Why was I reminded in that instant of the fact that when I was 10 years old living in London, I used to live in Paddington, and each week I would take two bus journeys to go to a swimming club quite a long way away in London, in Shepherd's Bush. And the bus I had to take from Paddington, the first bus I had to take from Paddington, was the 159. And I would change at Baker Street to another bus that took me to Shepherd's Bush. And where?
It's going backwards. Paddington to Baker Street. it
got me there. Where I changed buses in Baker Street, you get off the bus, and there was this shop that had everything that a vicious, violent 10-year-old would ever want, which is what I want. Namely, it was full of guns and knives. It's full of mortal weapons. And the sort of guns that you could buy if you were 18 were, I don't know what you call them in America, in Britain we call them air guns.
BB guns.
Okay, so you have a pump, you pump up a chamber with compressed air and back.
Shoot a little bit.
That's right. And there were two bores. It was 0.32, which was big, and it was 0.177, which is small. 159, 177. Is an absolutely unforgettable number for me, as you've seen. I wouldn't have any problem. But it's got nothing to do with science. It's got everything to do with my life. But if I was in an experiment in which I was being asked to remember seven-figure numbers, that one would have no... There would be no problem in remembering that I'd seen that one. And phenomenal calculators like Aitken, Edmund used to say, all numbers to him had immediate, you know, they were acquaintances. Oh yes, I know you, you're the square root of this plus whatever. that was his personal life, this was my personal life. If I'd been part of an experiment, the fact that I remembered that number and didn't remember others would be part of the background error variance. Well, who's got the error? The error might be that science constrains psychology to allow only one sort of variance to be significant. And it's quite upfront about it. You know, when I teach statistics, as I do, I say to the students that there are certain sorts of variance which we can impose on people, and there are certain sorts of variance that they bring along with them, because some people are good at this, some people are good. But we can't deal with that unless we are going to have a science of peculiar, unique instances. And so we have to, if we want to do this sort of work, we have to make a powerful decision about what we're going to allow to be data. And I think part of the agenda of this meeting, which excites me, is that we are actually involved in a Foucauldian exercise of who has got the power to say what is data, what are we going to allow to be data. And the sort of work that you are doing, for example, is something that 20 years ago in my neck of the woods, sort of work that you and Francisco did, would have been seen as very interesting, but not too fringe. It's all about experience.
Oh,
yeah, but we're Anglo-Saxons. We do science.
That's the way it was in our neck of the woods too.
Yep. And I think things are changing. And I wouldn't say things are swinging your way, but it's that perhaps we're more secure now. Science has won. We are what religion used to be. We are the people who say what is. In which case, we can relax a bit and say, well, maybe we could bring what happens in people's experience into a more even-handed relationship with scientific resources and techniques. And I think that's what's exciting about this movement. And in that rather ill-edited little bit of writing that I supplied for the meeting, I had this quotation from Einstein, which I find so moving. Einstein, a synopsist, believed that science had no reason to deal in experience itself. Before his death, shortly before his death, he wrote to the children of his lifelong friend, Michael Besser, who had just died. He wrote this: "And now he has preceded me, briefly, in bidding farewell to the strange world. This signifies nothing. For us believing physicists, the distinction between past, present, and future is only an illusion, if a stubborn one. Now, the primordial temporality of our existence in the world is something that Bergson said was in nature. Durée is there. And as far as Western science is concerned, he was wrong. He is wrong. He remains wrong. And if you read the otherwise wonderfully witty Bertrand Russell, his History in Western Philosophy, he just gets Bergson so completely wrong and has no space for Bergson or Nietzsche. And in that displays the very best and the very worst of British analytical traditions. And I think what is happening with the centenary of creative evolution and with the return of interest, as Harry Hunt puts it, there's a metaphysical shift going on. And the metaphysical shift, as Harry Hunt puts it, is, has there been perhaps an intriguing sea change in much of contemporary science, such that after several hundred years since the defeat of religion, after several hundred years of specific concentration on the linear and the inanimate, we are now beginning to seek out those physical properties of nature that actually mirror the form of our own existence. And I find that a powerful agenda, a manifesto. And one of the talks I didn't give here today starts with a paraphrase, a parody of the Communist Manifesto. A spectre is haunting science, and it's the spectre of meaning, the spectre of meaningful experience being part of the physical world. And I think we're part of the manifesto. It's interesting, Bergson's debates with Einstein actually contributed to his very sudden eclipse. I mean, Bergson was a towering figure up until about 1920, 1930, and then after these debates with Einstein that he is said to have lost in some sense. And, you know, Einstein famously after the debate said, may God forgive him. but I never will. Because Einstein seemed to think that Bergson was trying to recruit Einstein's ideas about the relativity of time and space to Bergson's own agenda that, as a stenosis, Einstein found unacceptable, mystical. It's so interesting that Bergson would say of something like this. So I see I'm coming up to about 30 minutes. I'll think of closing down in about 5. Bergson would say, you know, this machine made by using the resources of science, which works so well as a way of ordering the physical conditions of life so that we can go to the moon or have machines we do and so on, is said to record time. It does nothing of the sort. It holds a mechanism in which matter moves from one place to another at a regular pace.
It's an empirical determinant of the passage of time.
The passage of time is what is happening here. And the passage of that time, durée, cannot be measured by this, by such a machine, even though there must be some close relationship from time to time. I really didn't intend that one. I think that concludes the sorts of introductory remarks I wanted to make. I can very briefly, 5 minutes or so, look to the future, because if we do take Bergson seriously, and I want to, and if we do take Whitehead seriously, and he too is undergoing something of a renaissance, though, of course, in Britain, Whitehead is a museum piece, an amusing.
Only the second half.
Mm-hmm.
The first half of Whitehead isn't a museum piece.
No, that's true, though he's actually well known for having made a huge mistake about relativity and having produced a mathematical model of net relativity which was wrong. And so they say, well, yes, of course he did that great work with Russell, but of course that was wrong too. When he was doing mathematics, he was very clever, but he sort of tended to get it wrong. Then he did education at London University, but then he went to America and went mad and wrote crazy metaphysics for the rest of his life.
Because, which is really good stuff.
Because only the Americans would tolerate that. That's what I've been told. And there's something important there, because people with British accents sound more intelligent than they actually are. Stop that. But I think there is there is something important happening to do with the rediscovery of process metaphysics. I think the logic of the structure of scientific revolutions is a fundamentally important book, but incomplete or so good that it's going to constantly develop. And I think paradigm shifts start in metaphysics. I think as conflicting evidence builds up, it's not that new theories are created to hold these discrepant observations. It's that people move back and back and think, you know, we've got to rethink what we think the world is made of, for example. Recently, Galen Strawson has published a paper, I haven't read it properly, in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, saying the problem about the mind-body problem is that we don't realize how mind-like the body is. And I was very struck by your comments about embodied cognition. I think that's one of the most lively bits of contemporary cognitive science, and something which Merleau-Ponty is just tailor-made. It's such a pity that he died so soon. And his last work is his notes from the cours are slowly appearing in English under the title of La Nature. And in it, he refers to Whitehead quite a lot. To conclude, I think, as Claire said in her presentation, we need a new vocabulary to handle the techniques that you and other people, Francisco and others, are trying to develop to make first-person data legitimate in the scientific investigation of the mind.
Did you say that, Clive? Somebody asked you whether you should and didn't answer. I mean, I think it's a very peculiar notion that after, let's say, 500,000 years of evolution of language, that we need new words talking about the most important thing in our experience, which is what it's like to be human. I mean, I think we probably got it wrong if we think we haven't got the vocabulary.
Well, I think vocabulary is used in a kind of, at least while I use it, in a kind of looser or more searching for the word in my vocabulary to describe how I want to talk about it. And words like metaphorical are coming up, but there's a similar thing I was going to mention. L.L. White's book from the mid-20th century, Next Development in Man, where he talks about developing a process language. And I don't think he's talking about developing a new language, but he's talking about a new framework of communication or a sense of commonly understood concepts that is necessary to kind of expand communication around anybody or subject matter. See what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily new words, which becomes a very specialized thing, and more often than not, does not facilitate communication.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem to explain. How is it we've got this far and still don't have the words for it? If our things that need to be named and experienced to communicate about. I mean, my worry is that whether it's in dialectical materialism or Derrida or whatever it may be, people go off with a new set of concepts, a new set of metaphors, a new language, and isolate themselves from the rest of the community, talking only to themselves about something which in the end isn't substantial. So I think the case has to be made that we need a new language, but maybe Travis asked the question. You did not answer it. You need new words to talk about.
Yes, in fact, yes. For example, pre-reflective. I don't know if it's a good word, but we need a new word for pointing pointing this level of experience. This particular level of experience. There was no unconscious, it's not good. We need to agree, for example, with Russ, and we need to have a common word to point this level of experience. There is no word for that. Now, and there are other examples. For example, the different way to recall the past experience. We were just talking about that at breakfast. There are different ways to recall a past experience, but reliving is not really good. And we have to find a few, maybe three or four or 10 words in order to point these different ways. First, we have to identify them precisely, and then to find the new words. Really, because we have not got this word in our Western languages. In French, we have not. I guess in English, you don't.
But what would you say to the criticisms of someone like Nick and many others who, in the best sense, are sort of conservative about the vocabulary that we have? Conservative in the best sense, meaning we. And I'd say, you know, in the American context, of course, we have John Dewey, who says, you know, don't, and the whole pragmatist tradition, don't introduce a term unless the difference that it points to makes a difference. And the criticism from the traditions in which I grew up of the sort of proposal you just made, you know, we need a new term to talk about this, is that, well, if you continually multiply terms, you somehow devalue scientific language. If you simply say, for every phenomenon I want to draw your attention to, I'm going to give it a name, you get Derrida.
It's a question of intent, though. I mean, when I grew up, my sense was that there were all these specialized vocabularies, and they largely existed to exclude people. If you had to learn that specialized vocabulary, yeah, in that body, in order to be allowed to even comment within that field.
That's for sure.
And I think we're now moving in an era which is a little bit more democratized, in the sense that even some of the better intellectuals are trying to figure out a way of making their, you know, their more complex evolutionary views or whatever accessible to a broader public. So it seems to me, in that context, a new word is often tremendously refreshing. I mean, we laughed about this word grokking yesterday, but probably the power of a really weak otherwise, that word appears in an era where sort of a whole generation knew there was no word in the English language that captured that feeling. And I think maybe we are moving into an era when, you know, words like, whether it's pre-reflective or whatever the word is, there is a recognition that there's a need for that, but it is not a new word which is coming up to exclude or
But how do
you specialize? I have a very good example, so I'm sorry to jump in, but because as a practical matter, I've had to deal with this, because part of what I do is work, editorial work for Dharma Publishing. And so a word that gets used a lot in the books that Tartan Tulku writes about meditation is awareness. Awareness is a very simple word in English. It has a lot of meanings. David Chalmers, for instance, has a very weird idea of what I think of what awareness might mean. But in the meditative context, if you say, you know, we're not talking about mindfulness, we're not talking about concentration, we're talking about awareness, people can pretty easily get a sense of what that means. There is no such word in any of the other languages that I've worked on for translating that book. There's no such word in German, there's no such word in Dutch, there's no such word in Portuguese, there's no such word in Spanish, there's no such word in Italian. Those are the ones that I've worked on. And people have turned cartwheels trying to make it work. And the words that they've come up with, I've discussed with them on a number of occasions, and they don't work. They create an obstacle. In every single case, I can see that they are, you know, unless you create a new word, which that's one approach they've taken, and then you have your own problems, but the fact that that word doesn't exist creates an obstacle to understanding what the original English is about. It's a very simple word. It's a word we take for granted in English. So it's a good example.
There wasn't any original English, though. There was Tarthan Tuggle's
yes.
thoughts in Tibetan, presumably.
Yes, yes, and he found it was useful to use the word awareness in English, but it's not useful in any other language.
How are we going to keep the lid on the proliferation of terms which become devalued because you are not conservative about your vocabulary, and every time you come up against a difficulty of using the old vocabulary, you say, I'm going to call it this, I'm going to say grok. And then you get into sort of postmodern jargon, which becomes a private language, deconstruction, get lost, and so on.
Well, I think that's the question. I think that's what I was trying to emphasize.
I think one element of this, in my experience, is that we don't pay a whole lot of attention to interactive processes. I mean, we have a fairly limited vocabulary, if you will, of ways to communicate. We give talks, you know, or we have debates, you know, a sort of framework of ways that we interact about things that we take seriously. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the dialogue process that's practiced pretty widely. You know, there's the MIT Dialogue Center, and there's an organization that I know called Viewpoint Learning that uses the dialogue process, which simply invests more time, for one thing, in people listening to one another until they get to the point where two people can say, okay, I get it, what you mean about pre-reflection, but I understand now what this grok business is. And if you work at it, which people generally don't do when they invent neologisms, they just throw them out there, or as you pointed out, they let them become a private language. I think if you work at it and understand that it does take a bit of work, you can get through a lot of those vocabulary issues.
Mm. Ross, you were going to say
something. I'll give an example that I think amplifies what Walt was saying, and that is that in my work, it's very frequently the case that somebody at their first sampling day or two will say they were thinking about something. And when you ask about what thinking was, for one person, that word might mean I was saying to myself in inner speech, quote, I should have a ham sandwich, unquote. And for somebody else, what that word thinking means is I'm having an image of a ham sandwich and no words whatsoever. And for somebody else, the word thinking means I was feeling a bodily craving towards hunger. And there are just wildly different versions of in inner experience about what that word thinking means. And I've come to understand that what thinking, the way it's a developmental thing, that people use the word thinking because when they're this tall, because they look around and they see, well, the thinking must be whatever's going on inside that guy. And whatever is frequently going on with me, that must be thinking. Of course, nobody else sees that. So if I'm a guy that has a lot of images, thinking is an image for me. And if you're a guy that has a lot of feelings, then thinking is a feeling for you. So I think the problem is almost never that we need more words. It's that we need to understand the words that we're using. And sometimes that requires making up new words, and pre-reflective may be one of them. But more often, this is what I think I took Walt to be, what I did take Walt to be.
You've got to say
that we need to understand that the words that we're using, and then if we need to make up new words, then we should do that. But I think that most of the time, much of the time, here and elsewhere, we don't exactly know what the other person is thinking, or what the other person is doing. And the thing that we do, it gets us in a lot of trouble.
Claire had something else.
Yeah, it's very close to what you just said. You don't think, or there is a danger specific to first-person methods, I think. We don't just need new words, but to experiment the experience behind these words.
Yeah.
And it's a real investment for people who really want to use these words. If it's only words, especially we can create hundreds of words and be very but we need to to experiment, to touch the experience, and for it's really another type of investment than just create words.
Yeah.
I want to add that I think that sometimes it's hard to realize the extent to which we're on the threshold or the verge of a really major enterprise, and that we're Pythagoras as compared to what mathematicians are doing now. Think of how his work has expanded into a magisterium, and what that magisterium is about to me is really exploring a kind of space that has objects, processes, dynamics, and much of which, as Claire's pointed out, are below the level of normal conceptualization, which is where words come out of conceptualization. So it's a tremendous challenge to develop a vocabulary, but without it, we won't be able to map this space successfully. And as far as in the tradition, the reply was, well, those who speak don't know, and those who know don't speak. In other words, ineffability. And yet, many mystical systems have very elaborate vocabularies, that some of which have been cross-referenced to describe these ineffable states. I think that it's going to be a challenge to master this vocabulary. This is going to be no different from theoretical physics or something, where you have to you can understand the surface level, but if you want to do it professionally, you really have to know your stuff, or mathematics in the same way. It might take several years to get to the point where you know what this particular state means. And we don't even know how to train people to get to that state yet, to replicate that experience reliably.
So, what's so odd is that, you know, we draw an analogy with theoretical physics, which needs new recovery. We're talking about subatomic particles, for example, which we have only known about and had any sort of access to through our new technologies in the last 50 years or so. Consciousness isn't like that. I mean, you know, consciousness is where we began. What's so surprising would be that you should say, or even imply that it's like doing...
Well, that's like saying consciousness is not like that. It's like saying the physical world is not like that. In each case, those are the subjects of the study. But what's new is that we have this incredible tradition of Western inquiry that we are willing to try to apply to this territory that has been explored for other reasons, for liberation and things like that.
It's funny you should use the word territory, and we have this vocabulary. There's a tremendous amount of neo-colonialism in it. and this is not, you know, as somebody who's British, who works in India, you know, I've got more of a problem with this than you have. But there is some sense of...
there's a whole Sanskrit vocabulary.
That's right.
For example, there's an awful lot of words referring to this that actually go back to at least the oldest history we have.
Sure.
But whether... reappropriating, for example, the Sanskrit vocabulary is the most effective way for communication and for shared inquiry. In some situations, I think there might be this few words there. There are others that I do not think would have the mimetic value that they would really communicate. That just takes me to one more point. I think in that sense, we can maybe trust evolution or cultural evolution a little bit, in the sense that certain new terms that we generate take hold. And they take hold because they spoke to something that did not get spoken to in another way. And others of us, in a dilettantish way, create words that don't take hold at all, because in the end they don't communicate, or they serve some exclusive purpose rather than, you know, than evolutionary purpose.
And there's a remarkable example at the center of our field, which is the phrase, what it's like to be, which has come into general use as a way of somehow pointing to a phenomenal experience since Hegel, I suppose, is the first.
Actually,
it's a great phrase because it's a very clumsy phrase.
Something it's like
we all somehow think we know what it's referring to, but actually, other languages can't even formulate this phrase. French, for example, the French translation of what it's like to be a bat was quel effet ça va faire d'être un chauve souris. What it's like is tandis. I'm not sure what comes to is that. It doesn't even begin to mean the same thing. What effect?
If you're a bat, example.
actually, the phrase what it's like was used 2 years earlier by Timothy Sprick in a paper delivered to the Aristotelian Society.
Earlier than Engels' paper.
Yeah.
Actually, it's
1971.
It's 5 years.
Can I bring that in? Frank Ramsey, the mathematician, said, you can't say it, and you can't whistle it either. And I sometimes think, we're trying to blow this concept out through the teeth. Not actually knowing what we're talking about.
Can I bring my session to an end with just some final remarks which actually jumped away from Claire's presentation, which I found enormously useful. Just a little phrase that sort of crept by at the bottom of the screen when you were having can we learn to notice pre-reflectively how the content of first-person experience comes to be what it is. And whenever I discuss this with my colleagues, particularly in the political context in Britain, where we're dominated by a fascist research exercise where the money is going to go where most papers are published, which is dark, I say, we should pay more attention to Indian traditions, to Buddhism particularly, and they say, look, we're a department of science, not a finishing school. If you want to train people to notice things about their experience, fine, but do it in California. Do it where people, do that sort of thing, but not in not when we're teaching students to do a BSc. And I don't know what to do with that. And your phrase, those minute gestures that create suffering, is the phrase that's lodged in my mind, because one of the things that I brought away from the Nima Institute in Berkeley is a couple of very rich conversations with people who work at the Family Life Center, where they try to take traditions of noticing your mind from the Tibetan traditions that they practice and apply them to people, young people particularly, who get into trouble for violence, for how do you come to think and behave like this? Instead of sort of, you shouldn't be bad, they're approaching them by saying, let's try and get some skills to noticing how your experience unfolds. And it seems to me that what you are doing fits perfectly in this. And lastly, I think we should all, especially those of us in the sort of countries that I work, my salary mostly comes from people's taxes, though increasingly it's coming from the pockets of students, which is their own. It's right that you should ask yourself of what. You should ask of what you do, who wants this, who needs it, I think we live at a time where we used to frighten ourselves about nuclear weapons, and we should have done, and we should still do. The existence of those things is a nightmare. We are now frightening ourselves about this current horror story we're telling us about ourselves about how we're destroying the world. I don't know whether we are or not. There's certainly tremendous change that we should pay attention to, and the role of human lifestyles in making that change, that's highly arguable. But it seems to me that if it is as important as it appears to be, then if all we're doing with first-person studies is playing with ourselves in some sort of Proustian way, looking into our own experience, then we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, and we shouldn't be doing that. I would say, and finally, this sort of, I hope, maybe links to something that Steve's been saying for a couple of years and always struck me as very important, that there may be some things which have intrinsic ethical content, even though they come from scientific traditions where facts and values seem to are supposed to be separate. And it seems to me that when we approach first person, when we approach consciousness, we can either take an ideographic approach, a first person approach, what has just happened, the sort of work that Russ does. Or we can take a nomothetic approach and we can study the neural correlates of consciousness and the like. But here we tap into that old agenda that comes to us from the myth of science defeating religion and giving us a new way, more reliable way to know the world. One way or another, science ends up as technology. We don't need Foucault to tell us that knowledge is about power and control. Now, it seems to me that written into an ideographic approach is that if there is to be any control, it is control of the self. It's control of your own mind. And it's one of the greatest ironies that the one mind you don't find in Western psychology is your own. That's the one thing you can't do. We tell our students, don't use the person pronoun in your essays. Don't say, I think. You know, I don't want to know what you did on your holidays. I want a scientific essay. And there's value in that, but the pendulum has swung too far in that way, in that direction. The traditions of Buddhism and other Indian traditions point to the science of an ideographic science of consciousness is about the control of your own experience, and hence the control of your own behavior. And I think your techniques are important in that respect. And this program is a powerful demonstration that it can work. And the contrast I often draw between science and Buddhism is that in Buddhism, which I'm not a Buddhist and I don't admire everything about Buddhism, it's wonderful, but you know, it's got some very repressive, rigid, conservative bits in it. In Buddhism, the theory changes and the science in Buddhism. The object is to change yourself. The theory stays the same. But in science, the opposite is the case. You don't expect chemists to be changed by doing chemistry, but you hope that they will change the theory of chemistry. And it seems to me that we've got an ideographic approach which inevitably is associated with internal change of the self, which has a certain value, cloud of value around it, while a nomothetic approach looking for the neural correlates of consciousness is it will inevitably end up as mind control. It seems to me there's no way that can be avoided, and that the sort of research that so depresses Thomas Metzinger, a great philosopher of consciousness, he's extremely worried about consciousness research, because he thinks it's opening the way to a new era of fascist mind control. And that last thing, and here the great powers of science to order external affairs as we wish, sort of thing that Bergson says, because it's so successful, it makes us think we've understood everything. We do need to pay attention to what we're doing in the world, if we are doing the damage we fear we're doing. And when you look into the ecological psychologists, people that I deal with, Arne Naess, Theodore Roszak, people like that, they point to the fact that if you wave the finger at people and say, the way you live is destroying the world, you get responses like George Bush's father at the Rio conference, when he was approached by people from South America who said that the problem is that people in the rich countries, America particularly, are over-consuming. That's what's damaging the world. George Bush Sr. said, the American way of life is not up for negotiation.
Yeah.
Period. And
sorry about that.
And Bush Jr. is doing well. Facing students who, this is the thing that worries, this is among the things that worried them. You know, when I was a student, I was worried that we were going to blow ourselves up. Still am. The students today are worried that we really are doing the damage we fear we are, and they want to, how can we help? And people like Rozak and others say, look, scare tactics and guilt trips won't work. They just make people, no, the hell with it. I'm going to run my gas-guzzling car, and the hell with you. And if we have the chance to educate generations of students to pay more respect to the ideographic traditions, we will be giving them a message below the radar that there are other ways to approach mental phenomena that might be intrinsically value-laden in a positive way. And I hope that bounces off things that Steve said over the past few years that I've paid attention to, and maybe opens the way for your talk.
John, I wonder if I could throw in just a few quick notes of things I scrawled in the margin. One of which I was just reminded of when you talked about the environmental issue. Quite a long time ago, it was the fall of '98. I got to be a fly on the wall at a conference of scientists at the Salk Institute, and quite a few big shot scientists, including Salk and Crick and Fred Seitz, who was the former president of Rockefeller University, was chairing it. And he was very strongly of the opinion that there's a lot of irresponsible talk in the general public about things that they ought to shut up about. Maybe specifically, his global warming issue was really just kind of beginning to hit the media at this point. And his statement, I can't recall the words, but the gist of it was very clearly that the media and the public should just shut up about, not speculate about this global warming climate change business until the scientists have come to a consensus about it. And then they can, then it would be all right. And I do remember the exact words of the comments that followed from Stephen Toulmin, particularly because he was speaking in a British accent. He said, Fritz Seitz has just given us an eloquent statement of an untenable position. And I thought it was a remarkable observation. And he was right on.
What was the response?
I don't think of
someone
with an American accent
trying to say that.
Shut up. Get back to
your hole.
Something like that. The other thing, just kind of semi-serious, just recently is something I was writing. I wrote a couple things, kind of extrapolating from, you're probably familiar with Arthur Clarke's statement that any sufficiently advanced technology is
indistinguishable from magic.
Right, indistinguishable from magic. So I wrote down two things. One is that any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from religion. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is any sufficiently advanced religion is indistinguishable from science. Mm-hmm. Which I don't entirely believe, but I kind of like it.
It's great.
The third thing was inspired by, I'm deeply touched by your appreciation of our toilet facilities.
We love
the
toilet facilities.
I may not be too proud of our toilets, but by God, we built good toilets.
We were looking around for the shovel, actually.
And the other. I was reminded by it of a comment from Baudrillard, quoted in a book of mine, where he said, Americans have no identity, but they do have wonderful teeth.
Sorry, just to follow on from that, but coming back to your plan though, I like it a lot, but I'm not a bit worried about these antinomies that you're setting up. For example, I mean, okay, Tom mentioned me worried about transcript methods being used to control experience. We've been in control of experience and others' experience for a very, very long time, using the conventional, well-established techniques of rhetoric, of conversation, of human discourse, which actually can, in the foreseeable future, I think, twist and distort and improve and engage with human minds at a level which science isn't even beginning to approach. So I don't really worry that new techniques are going to be, you know, somehow trumping all the things we've already been doing. I think we need to worry quite seriously about the techniques which we have already got for changing people's minds. And you know, in an essay which I wrote called "What Should We Tell the Children," which Richard Dawkins now quotes very widely, it's all about mind control by parents, religious parents, and controlling their children's ideas about the world and their destiny. I don't think it's new, this idea of controlling other people's mind. Equally, the techniques of ideographic exploration have also been used not only in relation to self-development, but also, again and again, to interaction and encouragement of others to follow in the way which is being, you know, this has been discovered by the first person explorer. So I don't think, again, it's as narcissistic as you're suggesting the Buddhist tradition.
No, I have to accept your points that there is nothing new under the sun. Well, perhaps that wasn't the point you're making, but I do take your point that it's not that we're suddenly into a new era where we have to be more careful than we've had to be before. What concerns me is the manner in which the vigor and the proper liberality, as in the Dewean sense of American culture, which is, you know, globalization is westernization, and westernization means America. So the world is becoming one place, and the place is America. And Baudrillard is, I think, one of the best people who writes about that. And with that comes, I do think, quantity changes quality. And while Nick is perfectly right that it's not news to say that science is used for control, and it's not news to say that we have manipulated the minds of other people down the ages, what else do you do when you try to communicate with somebody? But now I'm worried that in the sense of another principal influence on what I do is Walter Benjamin, and he says when culture loses control of technology, the result is violence and the celebration of violence. And I think technology has been out of control for about 200 years in a major sense. And by out of control, I mean the sort of things that, you know, anti-capitalists talk about. What some bright guy in informatics in Harvard finds a technique to use genetic engineering and computers to produce something that will make a profit, and somebody whose business is profit recognizes that they've got something, and billions of mobile dollars appear and make something that does, as Nick says, what has been done for years, only now it does it in spades. And I have to say, in the nicest possible way, that the Nyingma Institute strikes me as being, I'm trying to write something about it at the moment, it's the most delightful place to be. But having been to Tibet and seeing people spinning prayer wheels by hand, it's just such a hoot to come to Berkeley and see these gigantic prayer wheels being wound and spun constantly by electric motors. You know, if ever there was American go for it, can do attitudes to an old tradition. You know, and here, halfway up Berkeley, there are these prayers being radiated out in a superhuman level. Which is why.
Do you know who the first person was to think of that, to my knowledge, was Arthur C. Clarke? There's a story in they wrote in 1947. The nine talking about electric prayer wheels.
That's right. But they should at least be solar powered.
Next year, we must see the wind.
Electrons are electrons.
But the only point I would make is that Nick's perfectly right to say that we've always done that. What I'm worried about is the Marxist insight that quantity changes quality. And because we have the most powerful technology in the world today is the technology of creating desire. And it seems to me that as the internet spreads of images of desirable life around the world and creates needs and desires that are going to turn into behavior, we are tinkering with stuff that...
I think that you're absolutely right about that, but that is using the old techniques in new ways. So you're right, maybe a quality shift at some point. But I thought what you mentioned was what we're worried about are, you know, fMRI and, and transcranial stimulation. There's no evidence at all that that's ever going to pay off in any interesting way.
Really?
I don't think so, in terms of manipulating minds. And
I hope you're right.
But you can, I think it was mentioned yesterday, you can stimulate someone's left temporal lobe and they get experiences which they think of as mystical or religious or whatever you call them. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that, you can do a whole lot worse.
Well, you've stimulated left temporal lobes already with, you know, with drugs or with religious ecstasy or whatever. You know, Santa Teresa stimulated left temporal lobe by deep breathing, basically.
Really right. Danger is like the way you can diagnose illnesses in advance, propensity illnesses, by looking at people's DNA, and people are afraid that insurance companies would move.
That's not the story. Okay.
So fMRI could be used to perhaps at some point to identify possible dissonance and to deal with them.
Well,
good or bad.
But
you were talking about political misuse, and that's a possibility. If we could have just identified the few leaders in the 60s, we could have.
I'm worried we're eating into Steve's
time. I was just going to say, let's break now. It's 10:45, so let's start again at 11. We can go a little past 12. Let's just get to 3.
My main reaction is that I feel a lot less peace on that.
The story doesn't really tell you much about Buddhism, but the part about prayer wheels, I was amazed when I read that. You know, after I was a dream guy, basically it comes up because they say, well, we're going to install computers, let me ask some simple questions about that. And they say, yes, we installed it to run the
programs.
In human personality, it's not like what it is. What's being accomplished by the turning block. So therefore,
There are effects in the universe.
Use, As a technologist,
ideal in gigabytes.
And I'm aware of the amount of information just in this
room.
And so, this one fellow who was studying the space text, when he started to get information.
Give it up for it, that's what
you
say.
Respect by
Yo, we're fine.
So this this really does, in a way, follow on from John's talk, and probably from much as yesterday. But hopefully it takes things in a slightly different direction, I hope. So, and really, it's more about asking questions than giving answers. So I'm going to try and resist. I've tried to resist the temptation to lay a lot of my stuff on you, although there'll be a certain amount of that possibly. So the two concepts I'm trying to locate together, in very broad terms, the consciousness or experience. And value, and well, we've talked a lot about consciousness and what different things it could mean. And value is itself a term that may need to be clarified in many ways. But I'm primarily interested in ethics, and that's because I started out as a moral philosopher. And one of the things there seemed when I came across the sort of explosion of interest in consciousness in the 90s and subsequently, and the Tucson phenomenon, the Tucson effect, if you like, to give it a name off the top of my head. It reminded me of something, which was the sort of the way when I was a student of philosophy in the 60s, I found myself part of a new explosion of interest in ethics and a feeling that one could make progress in ethics and in discussing value after a kind of closing down as a result of emotivism and logical positivism during the 30s, 40s and 50s. And I've been fascinated for the last few years about tracing similarities between the structures of arguments and the progress of debates in the area of consciousness, particularly philosophical debates, but also debates about about science in relation to consciousness, and debates about ethics, about how much progress we can make in establishing ethical truth or what are the right ways to live or things like that in the area of ethics. And I think there are lots of other reasons for thinking that the two domains, consciousness and value, consciousness and ethics, are have interconnections. I'd like you to think about this. In fact, I'm going to propose a short exercise for us to do as a kind of classroom task in a few minutes. And then, in a little while, I'll say a bit more about some of the things that I think on this. And then I'll ask you to tell me what you've written, really, in your exercise. I might possibly do it as a sort of pairwise discussion thing, where you get into pairs and find out, pick each other's brains, because that sometimes helps. It does with students. I don't know whether it will help with people here, but anyway. I'm going to start, though, just to set the scene, by giving some examples from one of Sue Blackmore's books, a recent book that she wrote, which is a series of interviews. I think, Wendell, you were talking about Sue just now, weren't you? So she interviewed 20 psychologists, neuroscientists, philosophers, who she saw as central to the consciousness field. Most of them she interviewed at various Tucson meetings or ASSE meetings. She just published the interviews in an almost totally unedited way. So you get lots of yeah and sort of kind-alike coming in. But and obviously, I think some of the comments made by these people possibly were things that they maybe perhaps rather regretted saying. And in the preface, she said, well, you know, some people did ask if they could have rather edited versions of their conversations printed, and I resisted that request. So.
I refused to do it.
Yeah, she basically. You refused to do it. Oh, okay. But just that reason, possibly. Okay. Well, maybe we'll get yours alongside these in a little while. So here, I just went through this. The first time I read this, I was quite interested by the fact that a number of the people interviewed did seem to suggest a link between, you know, their interests in consciousness or why they thought consciousness was important and something to do with value or ethics in some broad way. And then I went through again trying to find them, and in fact I found rather fewer passages that really were demonstrative of this than I had originally thought. But I came across a number, and I've selected five, which I'll just kind of give you now. The first one was with Christoph Koch. And Sue said to him, well, how has studying all this changed you as a person? And he basically said, well, in a very practical way, I don't squish bugs anymore unless they attack me. And that's because I'm a biologist. And most pet owners would agree that cats and dogs are conscious and that the monkey is conscious. And you can ask, how low does it go on the evolutionary ladder? And that expresses a very kind of common concern of how, you know, consciousness seems to provide us with a certain kind of ethical relationship to things which are conscious. Although he's not saying that explicitly, but I'm taking it as a kind of implicit. That somehow, you know, if something is conscious, if you see something as conscious, when you see it in this particular way, you value it in a certain way.
I think that's the other way. Basically, I mean, if you ask Christoph Koch, do you squish primroses? He probably said no as well.
He might have done it, and, you know, that's true too, and that's something we can maybe pursue. Then another a conversation with Stephen LaBerge, who's the sort of master of lucid dreaming. In the course of his conversation, he expanded on how he thought lucid dreaming led to certain kind of interests in Eastern, various, you know, Eastern meditative approaches. And so she then said to him, "Well, do you think a science of consciousness must necessarily entail questions of transformation?" And he said, "Yes. Eastern traditions have been working at this inner knowledge for thousands of years. And I think that we in the West have a unique opportunity of benefiting from an interaction with that Eastern tradition, bringing in the Western scientific perspective." This is all probably very familiar stuff to us. Some of the things we've been saying, in the Ratnaling sessions. I think the collaboration of these two perspectives is what will give us the potential to understand consciousness in a new way, and then make use of the value that it has in becoming fully what we might be. So there's another perspective on, you know, a possible relation between consciousness and value, which is that studying consciousness may actually help in a kind of self-transformation, in a sort of self-realization. And that links, I think, to what Jack was saying about, you know, trying to think about how to become conscious differently. And I think the whole, you know, a lot of other things that we've been talking about. Then this comes from Roger Penrose, who, as you know, has among the many things that he's sort of famous for, is this very public opposition to the idea that computers or could be intelligent or indeed conscious, and. I thought this was very interesting because I actually shared a lot of Roger's scepticism, although not for his reasons. But
And I like this because it actually speaks to me, and it's something. It's, you know, one of my hang-ups is just this point I think that morals has everything to do with consciousness, because without consciousness, somehow morals evaporate. I remember having an argument with a computationist, I've forgotten who it was now, where the question of morality came up, and this person just didn't understand what consciousness had to do with morality. And I thought, what? I mean, if you bought a computer which is conscious, you'd have a responsibility. It's a moral issue. And, well, you know, I could unpack that. And maybe many people would disagree, and I'd be very interested to hear those, you know, what people have to say about that. Here's a conversation with Petra Sturi, who's a philosopher and a neuroscientist. She asks, Susan asks Petra, very near the beginning of the dialogue, I want you to tell me why consciousness is so interesting and difficult. And I guess this must have been in Antwerp, at one of those consciousness conferences. And she said, why is it interesting? That's an easy question. Of course it's interesting, because it's the basis of all our joys and pleasures and pains and tragedies and so on. From my point of view, consciousness is a prerequisite of experience. And experience is what makes us happy or sad, or enjoy the sunset or a glass of wine or a wonderful Belgian meal. And so here there's a sense of consciousness as being the focus for some aesthetic quality as much, or maybe even in place of, the sort of more moral aspects of value, which we saw in, for example, in Roger Penrose. And then finally, Francisco Varela, this was, I think, one of his last interviews before he died. I mean, there's lots of stuff in Francisco's writing which one could quote, and this is not by any means the best, and it was the best I could find in that particular interview, which is a bit, you know, disappointing, but there's enough of the real Francisco here, I think, to make it worth quoting. So the question is, why is it that consciousness feels so personal, so intimate, so central to who we are? And of course, that's why it's so interesting. The study of consciousness is a kind of singularity in science, because you're studying precisely the most cherished quality of what it is to be alive. And I think that, you know, obviously comes close to what Petra was saying, but says this in a much more profound, sort of existential way. And also suggests that it somehow, because it's to do with this, the most valuable thing about aliveness, that makes it, brings it to the heart of science, but also makes it something very singular in science. So I think there are some very interesting themes raised by those things. And as you can see, although they're all a little bit vague and impressionistic, there are a number of connections that are being set up there. And here's just one way of organizing, you know, three themes from those quotes. Consciousness is a basis of quality of life, or something a bit like that. The idea of seeing a being as consciousness as assuming a kind of ethical responsibility, and the idea of understanding consciousness as leading to the possibility of self-transformation. I think there are probably others, and you know, I'd like to know what other themes we might come out with. Just a little bit, just something about values, because the concept of values can be understood in different ways, and all the concepts in ethics, in the study of ethics, both the empirical study and the sort of philosophical study, can be understood in two principal ways that I just want to distinguish, just to get this out of the way. You can understand value in a kind of descriptive way. For example, you know, psychologists can ask questions like, how do children develop, you know, grow morally? How do they develop a moral sense, or, you know, become, you know, get some kind of moral consciousness, if you like? Is all motivation essentially selfish, which perhaps is discussed by psychologists, is certainly discussed a lot by philosophers. What's the difference between ethical and aesthetic value, which is, again, a sort of philosophical question. And that's all sort of descriptive questions about values and ethics and so on. But then there's also a kind of normative way. There's a sort of set of normative questions you can ask, which are like the traditional questions asked by Socrates, Plato, and so on. How should we live? How should societies be organized? what makes something beautiful, ugly, and so on, where you're actually trying to make value decisions, if you like. So these are asking value questions. You're trying to establish norms rather than talk about the norms that people happen to adopt, or the way that normative practices unfold. I hope I've just said enough to give you a flavour of the kind of exercise that I'm interested in our conducting. I mean, I don't know if anyone wants to ask for any further clarification at this point. Because what I'd like to do now is to get you to jot down, just, you know, I hope I haven't been, as it were, prefiguring your ideas too much, but just to take a kind of open mind to it and think about what you see as the relationship between consciousness as a field of study, or as a concept, or as a phenomenon on the one hand, and value, ethics, you know, different kinds of values, as a field of study, as a phenomenon, as a set of concepts. On the other hand, what do you think of as the interconnection? And I think it would be nice, rather than just do this as a solitary exercise, if you just like to discuss it with your neighbour, just as a way of, you know, so that each could act as a kind of midwife to the other in this. And here are some other questions which might help. Some of the things that I'm interested in particularly is, if you can find links between, you know, certain strands of consciousness and strands of value, do you see these links as somehow external, they just happen to be associated together closely, or are they internal in that there seems to be some kind of essential connection? I borrowed terms that Nick used yesterday, necessary versus contingent, just as a way of, you know, helping to clarify what I mean by that question. I don't mean external in the sense of out there and internal in here. I mean, is the relation between whatever relations you find yourself wanting to set up, are those relations somehow intrinsically, is there an intrinsic connection, or is it an extrinsic connection? It just happens to be the case that for us, or for most of us, that this connection holds, but there's nothing, you know, really there. I don't know, if you find that question doesn't make sense to you, just ignore it. But it may come back later on. It may, you know, you may find it relevant later on. Then there's a sort of methodological question. What methods might you use to investigate the connection? And, you know, are they first-person methods or other kinds of methods, for example? And then I'm interested, you know, you might have some thoughts about how this issue of the link between consciousness and value relates to science. I mean, obviously there was that sort of a sentence from Varela there, from Francisco there, but there may be other kind of things you might want to say about how this relates to science. And this, of course, you could draw in any of the things that we've been talking about over the last couple of days. Is that sufficiently clear as a thing to do? I'll set the clock. It's now just about 25.
You can do this in 5 minutes, sort of.
2.5 minutes each.
Well, yes, I mean, yeah.
Then what are you going to do with the answers?
Well, what I'm going to do is ask you to save the answers.
Pass them along.
On slips of paper. Well, no, just to save the answers. Right. And then I'm going to talk a bit more about some of my ideas about it. And then I'd like to hear the answers, maybe after you've had a little bit of time to reflect on it, you know, unconsciously or semi-consciously or consciously, in relation to what I'm going to say and what you, maybe others have said, you know, if people ask me questions. And we can maybe then go back to those, what you've written.
Can I suggest that we either do this individually or you give us more time for collaboration?
Oh, is that okay?
I mean, one or the other, I mean, I don't think it matters so much.
Okay, well, do people agree with my thought? I've got no real...
Let's just do it individually.
Okay.
Just to get each other to understand each other's... You know,
okay. All right.
Well, would you clarify again the external, internal?
Well, if it doesn't really if it doesn't make sense to you, just miss it out, because it's just one of the things that I'm interested in, for reasons which may become clear later on. But if it doesn't make, if I haven't given you enough of the context, then forget it.
Well, the reason I ask you is I personally don't think about value a whole lot consciously. And I mostly think about it unconsciously, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that's essentially what you were getting at.
It wasn't, but that's a valuable thing to say. You know. And I think one of the things that, I mean, I guess one of my points here is that I'm interested in, well, I think there are actually very strong relations, and they're actually multifarious. And I think it's very important for people who are in the sort of business of trying to understand consciousness to become more aware of these relations, and the things we don't often bring them to our explicit, we don't often make them explicit. So this is really a chance to make some of these links explicit.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Of course, if you think there aren't any links, that's important to say as well, or aren't any significant ones, that's important to say. I'll just give you another couple of minutes, and of course you may want to carry on writing ideas down, and you may want to amplify or tear up what you wrote later on. Okay, well, it's wonderful to see the difference between people, actually. So some people are writing feverishly, and some people are sort of thinking, you know. Okay, so if I may, I'll continue, and we'll come back to these, you know, later. Well, I'm going to, the way I'm going to organise my discussion is really in terms of two strands, which I call parallelism on the one hand, and cross-fertilization on the other hand. And I'm going to spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes talking, just giving you some of my own ideas about certain kinds of parallelism, which I just hinted at earlier in the very start of this talk. And then I'll give you possibly a few of my ideas to do with cross-fertilization, which may also come up in some of your in some of the things that you thought of, or you know, and I hope maybe that there are other sort of links as well in the second strand. So first of all, to do with parallelism, what I'm getting at here is really something to do with the relationship between the way people have discussed consciousness and the way people have discussed value. And I mentioned earlier this. These parallels that I found between the arguments that people were using about consciousness, particularly over the hard problem of consciousness. You know, why is it that the brain and you know all this of brain and behaviour and functionality should actually have the conscious feel of what it's like associated with it? You know, that Chalmers and Co. and Nagel and so on have made. That made you know so important for us over the last years, and of course that relates to an ancient. I mean, people sometimes just say, "Well, this is just the most recent way of expressing the mind-body problem," which of course is a cluster of problems. But it's essentially what's the relationship between the mental and the physical, between my mental. My sense of myself as having a mental being and my sense of myself as having a physical existence. And there's another sort of ancient debate in ethics, which is to do with the foundation of ethical value. How do we actually establish what the basis of ethical judgments are? And that became spoken about in the sort of 60s, around the 60s, well earlier than the 60s, but as a sort of the fact value problem or the is ought problem. In fact, there's a philosopher in Berkeley whose name begins with S, who has been quite important in the consciousness field, whose first famous papers was called How to Derive an Ought from an Is.
He failed.
Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Okay. So, I rather thought at the time that he didn't hack it, but anyway. And one of the things that I found myself thinking about this one, it was actually, there was a kind of moment of realization when I suddenly thought, what David Chalmers is saying is very much like G.E. Moore talking about good, about the indefinability of good, and the fact that goodness, for Moore, goodness was had to be a non-natural quality, because he was convinced that there really is objective goodness in the world. There are things that you know, when we think of things as being good or right, we're actually, in some sense, cognizing real objective features of the world. But it can't be anything that we can simply equate with natural features of the world, like the tendency of actions to produce happiness, which is what utilitarians or many utilitarians thought goodness was. Because Moore said you can always ask a question, but is happiness, is the tendency to produce happiness itself good? And that the fact that that question makes sense shows that goodness can't actually mean, the term good can't mean conducive to happiness. And that actually, when I read David Chalmers talking about the zombie problem, or Frank Jackson talking about colorblind Mary, if you don't know about these, we'll talk about them later. But anyway, there was a very similar feel to what was going on here, particularly Chalmers saying, well, we can imagine, we can't equate, we can't define consciousness or equate consciousness or reduce consciousness to brain processes or functional processes, because we can, consistently imagine a world where everything physically is exactly the same as our world, but everyone is a zombie in this special philosophical sense, not the Shaun of the Dead sense, but the philosophical sense of, there's nothing going on inside. Okay, they're talking, they're swimming in the sea and doing all the things that we do in exactly the same way. They're fixing budgets and driving cars
and writing about
the hard problem, etc. But there's no consciousness inside. And Chalmers took some care to say that that was actually a very that there was nothing conceptually absurd about that supposition, and because of the lack of conceptual absurdity, we can't ontologically equate consciousness with anything physical, with any brain processes or more abstract computational processes. And therefore he went on to say maybe we have to take some kind of dualist position, though he said he was a kind of naturalistic dualist, or he's since then maybe come away from this position, and that consciousness must be some kind of special feature of the world, which could be incorporated within science, but it had this special ontological status, not actually being part of the physical universe at all, but nevertheless being linked to physical processes in the brain, in the body, through some kind of set of bridging laws. And he saw it as a kind of ultimate feature of the universe, rather like electromagnetism. In fact, he rather saw himself as a kind of new Maxwell, really, having to postulate a new entity, a new process in the world, which had to be taken alongside of the others, and allowed us a new expanded science, a kind of science of psychophysics. Now, it seemed to me that he was saying something, I don't know if you can catch this similarity, saying something similar to Moore. And that got me thinking about the range of arguments which were sort of set up in ethics and in consciousness studies. And, these arguments actually work on various planes. There are ontological discussions, there are epistemological discussions to how can we know things, conceptual problem, which is very much, how do we know about what's going on in other people's first-person consciousness, conceptual problems, what do the terms mean, there are methodological problems, and so on. And there seem to be many similarities between the two. And I just, and also, there's in each area, there seems to be this kind of very, this talk of a gap. on the one hand, there's the gap between consciousness and brain, so consciousness and physical properties of the brain body. And on the other hand, there's a gap between value and fact, or between ethics and facts. So then I started to get interested in the parallelism between the way people discuss the mind, the explanatory gap, as it's sometimes called, of consciousness, and the what might be called the justificatory gap in ethics. I'm going to leave this bit out because I don't think I want to go into that. But it seemed to me that in each domain there's a kind of special feature. Nick mentioned the what it's like. We've talked about the what it's like, we've talked about qualia. People find it very difficult to find an acceptable vocabulary for this, but I think we all know what we mean when we talk about that special felt quality, which seems, which people sometimes talk about as the phenomenal aspect of consciousness, or phenomenal consciousness, sometimes contrasting it with other kinds of consciousness, like functional consciousness or access consciousness, and so on. And I just use the word phenomenality, perhaps, to refer to that. And in ethics, there's been discussion also about a kind of special feature of our sort of ethical beliefs, or more generally of our evaluative beliefs, which is that, if I think about the fact that there's a tray on the floor over there, I'm just making a fact about factual judgment about the world. But if I say something like, well, that tray looks a bit untidy, where it is, and someone might kick it over or trip over it, so really it ought to be moved, it's a bad idea for it to be there, then I'm, in a sense, there's a practical or prescriptive element to my thought, which in that it somehow links with my tendency to act, to remove it, or to tell someone to remove it, or something like that. I don't know if that is at all clear. There's quite a lot of theory involved there in sort of ethics, and it's hotly, I have to say, it's hotly contested within ethics, just as the concept of phenomenality is hotly contested within consciousness studies. So just as many, we have the eliminativists like, the Churchillians, maybe Dennett, who say, well, it's, when you talk about this special first-person phenomenal feel, you're not really talking about anything very coherent. So similarly, people in the area of ethics, would strongly challenge that account I just gave of sort of evaluative beliefs. That's why I said perhaps then. But clearly there are people who challenge the. But he does challenge the idea of. He certainly challenges the coherence of the notion of qualia, because he defines qualia in a way that bundles in ineffability and privacy and so on. But he doesn't deny that people are conscious. So maybe there's a kind of dilemma in each case, which is that in the area of consciousness, how are you going to get a theory of consciousness that on the one hand can explain how consciousness happens to be in us? In other words, grounds it in the rest, in whatever else objectively we are, which in some way is unproblematic, or at least is can be dealt with by less problematic methods within science, perhaps. And yet at the same time doesn't emasculate or obscure this special feature of consciousness, which I call phenomenality, but you can give it whatever name you like. And in ethics, you can take this dilemma as saying something like, well, how can you get a theory of ethics which on the one hand can ground it in objective features of the world, or at least can make certain ethical precepts objectively right, and others objectively wrong, or at least can rule some out as objectively wrong. Let's say the practice of slavery, to use a kind of topical example. At least can we have a theory of ethics which can show that someone who says I think it's justified to, you know, practice slavery, to kind of get people against their will and make them, you know, live their lives totally subject to other people's will and sell them, on the, you know, in the market and so on. How can we do? How can we show that that sort of precept, which is a sort of dream of at least some ethical philosophers, and many others would say, of course, you can't do it. You know, why are you bothering? But you know, one wants to think at least it's, you know, explore whether it's possible. And the problem is, how do you do that without at the same time just reducing, you know, ethical precepts to sort of factual statements of, you know, just scientific law that have the same kind of inertness as the statement that, you know, there's a tray on the floor. You know, that, in other words, they leave out that kind of prescriptive element. So that's the sort of the parallel, one of the ways that I would express this parallel between the two areas. And in fact, there are many responses, you know, many of the responses that are found within the fields sort of match up with each other. So I've already talked about the sort of invocation of a special entity or property, on the one hand by people like Chalmers, on the other, this much earlier date, you know, at the turn of the century, by Gene Moore. And you could see sort of reductionist approaches in the area of consciousness studies as very much mirroring some of the what are called naturalistic theories in ethics, which say, well, actually, ethics is really all about promoting welfare. That's essentially what it's about. And so you can reduce ethical questions to questions about what courses of action in fact will promote welfare and maybe perhaps promote certain kinds of distribution of welfare. That's just an example of a naturalistic ethical theory. There are others. And then of course there are eliminative views in both areas. I've already mentioned the Churchills, for example, Dennett, who try to say that the key concepts involved are actually based on confusions. And there are also people who say that in ethics, that the concept of the idea of there being an objectivity to ethics is a confusion. So this idea that I was, you know, just canvassing, that at least it should be possible to show objectively that slavery is wrong, is just looking for something that we can never find. So that's, you know, that's a kind of view in ethical theory. So there are these parallels. It's quite deep parallels. And then there's, you know, and this is something I mentioned before. In the 20th century, there was this sort of legacy of logical positivism and views associated with positivism, which in fact predated it, that actually apply to both the study of consciousness and the study of ethics, and which in their different ways eclipsed serious thinking, creative thinking, rigorous thinking about those areas for decades. And Hilary Putnam mentioned this in a recent lecture that's on the internet, which she gave in Dublin two or three weeks ago, called The Fact-Value Dichotomy and Its Critics. And he pointed out that logical positivists claim that ethical statements and value statements in general are cognitively meaningless and not amenable to rational discussion. And yet, as he put it, ethical questions are the ones that most of us think as the most important in life and as being the most important to discuss rationally. But for this sort of central period in the century, that there was a kind of almost a moratorium on discussing ethics. And he quoted writers like C.L. Stevenson, who just, you know, said that the only kind of way you could argue in ethics was in a sort of persuasive way. There was no rational argument in ethics. It was just a matter of persuasion. So it was just like advertising, you know, where you were trying to get people to, you know, come to a certain, you know, to do things or to feel things or to want things. And that's, yes.
Just really, do you happen to know how well this went down with Putnam's audience? I know a whole bunch of people who were planning to go to this, and they were not people who would be sympathetic to it. They were sympathetic to logical positivism, and it's, you just don't know.
I don't know that. Well, most of what he had to say was a deep critique of the of that yeah. Of yeah. the effect, the influence that still has.
Yes.
You know, and he was saying how he and a number of other people he mentioned in particular, he talked about Stanley Cavell,
yeah.
Had tried to create a deep sort of counter blast to this. In the area of consciousness, there's also been this eclipse, and in fact, you know, it goes back to pre-positive, has its roots in, well, in a kind of, certainly not in the Vienna Circle, but in John Watson's paper, which was 1913, was it? Mm-hmm. The paper about, where he said, you know, consciousness has no place in psychology. But psychology is the behavior receives it. Yeah, and actually, I would, if I'd had time, I'd have put that up just so to remind us of the things he said there. And actually, contrasted it with the paper, or compared it with a paper written by Henri Poincaré, which I think was he wrote in 1912 and was published in his posthumous collected works in 1913, where he spoke about the impossibility of a science of ethics. Because he saw ethics as essentially, you know, ethical statements as being imperatives, whereas science, whether it's mathematical science, you know, the sort of a priori mathematical sciences or the empirical sciences, as being always indicative statements, and you know that the lack of contact between ethics and science was a lack of deductive relationship between imperative and indicative, and. You know, I think it's significant that those two things were both being said around the same time. So, but interestingly, that the kind of marginalisation of consciousness probably lasted longer than the marginalisation of ethics, because although perhaps you could see the rise of cognitivism in the 50s and 60s as a sort of the resurrection of the inner. But it was maybe the resurrection of a rather emasculated kind of inner, because it, you know, it was still in many places. I don't know whether you would agree with this, Nick, because your experience, you know, you were working in maybe part of this movement. But you know, it was still, in many places, just not allowed to talk seriously about consciousness. Maybe you were one of the grand exceptions to that. I don't know. You know, people like you mentioned. Tony Marcel yesterday, maybe it was one of the others. Anyway, so I think there are some interesting historical links there which are to do with this influence of positivism and its aftermath, which I'd be interested in your comments on. So so I wonder whether you agree with these parallels. If you do, then I think the fact that there are these parallels is itself perhaps a finding, which may be worth valuing in itself. I don't know. And then this is where if I were going in that direction, I would then try and look at the question of, well, are there perhaps parallel solutions for the two problems? And is there something, or is it even the case that there may be some single overarching theory from which we can derive a solution to both problems in a kind of common way? But I'm not going to do that now. And instead, I'm going to just go on to... perhaps I'll just say this. Okay, just a little taste of what I think. It may be that the problem here is something to do with objectivity. In both cases, there's this obsession often with a grounding... both the problem, each of the problematic concepts or the problematic phenomena, with something that we feel at home with, and that we associate with objectivity, with the world that's there, and there is a sort of concept of objectivity there, which itself can be challenged, and of course has been challenged in many quarters, and maybe one way to get round both dilemmas is to pursue that critique of objectivity. I'm probably at this stage going to skip to my second strand. Here I'm just going to say something very, very brief and then get on to asking for your ideas, you know, on the basis of what you wrote down before. So here are some of my ways of suggesting, you know, this is a different kind of way of approaching the area of the links between consciousness and value, which is, in what ways are they, is there a kind of cross-fertilization or entanglement, to use a word that's very fond, that physicists are very fond of, or inter-animation. And I just mentioned a few of my own sort of ideas, and I think there's possibly a long list could be developed, and maybe there are ways of organising this list. And I haven't really done very much work on this, which is one of the reasons why I'm interested in some contributions to it. But here are just some ideas. Well, firstly, I mean, we can look at the sort of the ways that moral concepts link actually with phenomenal concepts. And if you take the notion of welfare, which is a key notion in many moral discourses, very many types of moral discourse. Clearly, a key notion of welfare, not the only notion of welfare, it's not the only aspect of welfare, but a key part of things going well with you is to do with the state of your consciousness, so being in a relatively positive state of conscious feeling more of the time than not. Some of the key terms in moral discourse, such as benevolence, sympathy, interests, care, happiness, suffering, empathy, of course, all seem to imply a focus on people's states of consciousness, on having regard for what it's like to be that person at any particular time, and how one's actions can actually affect what it's like to be them. In fact, you know, there's an important role for asking what it's like in ethics. It comes into ethics, although maybe not put in quite those terms. One is constantly finding discussions within ethics about questions like, well, how, you know, if I want to consider a certain action of mine from a moral point of view, I have to ask, well, how would it be like? What would it be like if that action were done to me? You know, if I was going to submit my practice as a slave owner to moral scrutiny, then I should maybe ask myself the question, well, what would it be like for me to be that slave there, sitting on that galley ship or whatever? Obviously that's, you know, part of the Kantian way of getting ethics to converge on certain practices, although it's not put in a very Kantian way. Okay, so that's just one possible link. And then there's a link from the other direction. It seems that you could take phenomenal attributions as having a kind of evaluative significance. And one of the most important things about our phenomenological states is that they do have this polarity. They do have a positive or negative tone. So, you know, it's not always the case. And Russ, you may have some interesting things to say about this. But you know, if you ask someone, what is it like for you at this moment? You know, you might say things. You might talk in very neutral terms, but you might say, well, actually, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable because I've been, you know, sitting in the same position for ages. I need to stretch my legs, or, you know, I'm getting a bit bored or whatever. Or you might say, well, I'm feeling really happy because this is connecting with things I've thought about for a long time, or I'm looking forward to lunch or something, or, you know, I'm feeling the lovely texture of this sort of, you know, this material, and that's, you know, that's really pleasant. You know, so your conscious feeling isn't just a feeling of a certain quality, a certain phenomenal quality, but it has a pleasant or unpleasant, positive or negative aspect to it. And that seems to me to be important and probably under-discussed. that's possibly putting it mildly. People obviously discuss the polarity or the valency of emotion, but it seems to me that, that phenomenal qualities in general, qualia in general, have this, at least this propensity, this readiness to take on a polarity. Now this partly connects with this question of internal versus external. Is it something that's essential? Is there something essential to conscious feel that it has this polarity, or what it might call readiness for polarity? Because clearly there are neutral feels, just as indeed there are neutral emotions, you know. But maybe that's just a bit like neutral colours, which are not neutral, not uncoloured. There may be some interesting things that people might want to say there. Then there's a question of constituency. People sometimes talk about the moral constituency. Should we, do we have any moral responsibilities towards animals, towards fetuses, towards people, with PSD states and so on? Debates about the contours of the moral constituency have become really prominent in recent decades. I mean, since Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, which was had an important influence on me, and debates within within sort of the philosophy of AI about the possible entry of future robots or extraterrestrials or whatever into the moral constituency. And of course, when we discuss those issues, we often discuss them in terms of, well, you know, would such beings be conscious? Do they have conscious awareness in the way that we take it for granted that humans, or at least all adult, normal humans, do? And often the two questions get discussed in very close juxtaposition. So one finds people saying, well, because I believe, say, that consciousness is a higher order phenomenon, and essentially something that's rational, maybe involves conceptual abilities, I don't think that animals actually have consciousness in the sense that we have it, and in that crucial sense. And that's why I think it's okay for me not to be a vegetarian. Well, you think you haven't heard people talk that way, because I have. I have also heard people.
Argument you were presenting.
Sorry.
I thought it was an argument you were presenting.
No. I'm just giving that as an example of a position that people may adopt. You know, where they actually are making a kind of explicit link between discussions about the nature of consciousness, how they view the constituency of consciousness, and how they view the moral constituency. I mentioned brain sort of uploads. That's one of the cases. I mean, there are people like Ray Kurzweil who are hoping that they'll still be around when the technology of silicon uploads has got to the stage where he can sort of upload his the contents of his brain, whatever that means. The context of his consciousness down to his I've seen sort of TV shots of him, you know, desperately kind of going on a running machine, keep himself alive, sort of thing, and of course he's interested in there's a kind of moral issue there for him. At least a value issue. He wants to remain alive, because he wants to be conscious. So there's a sort of another way of illustrating that issue. And then, of course, there's something to do with the centrality of practice. Clearly, practice is central to ethics, and I think it's now, in many ways, when we talk about embodiment, inactive approaches to consciousness, we're seeing consciousness very much as activity, rather than as something that just happens up here inside the head. I think there possibly may be ways of developing a kind of common framework of theory. And I've been working on this with Eric Mayen, to try to develop a kind of common inactive approach which will provide a sort of account of consciousness and of ethics. But I'm not going to say any more about that here, or at least not now. And then there are various other things. I just noted down, on the basis of conversations we've been having, some other concepts. The concept of grokking is one that I've enjoyed for many years, because it seems to fuse the descriptive and the evaluative. When we grok, as I understand its use in Hyland's original book, when we grok something, we both conceptually understand what it is and appreciate its beauty. And the idea is that you can't do the first without doing the second. And, you know, a mathematician might say, certain kinds of mathematicians might say, you can't understand numbers unless you can appreciate their beauty. You know, again, it's a matter of debate, but I think it's a matter of debate within epistemology as to whether you can, you know, whether you can actually prize apart the purely cognitive aspect of understanding from the affective or evaluative aspect. One way that this is, I don't think I'm going to have a chance to go into this, but there's a debate in ethics about thick and thin ethical concepts, and I think there's a similar debate that can be had in the area of consciousness, but I don't think I'm going to talk about that at the moment. But it's much easier to see this, you know, one example of this maybe is concepts of health and well-being. Clearly that, you know, that biology is a science and deals with, if you like, how living systems work, just putting it in a very kind of crude way. But also central to biology is health. And insofar as the neuroscience of consciousness relates to biology, it's maybe there is a sort of, you know, maybe neuroscientists, when they discuss consciousness, should also be discussing how health or similar concepts come into consciousness. So that actually maybe, you know, these evaluative issues actually are at the heart of what we call third-person approaches to consciousness as much as to first-person approaches. I don't think I'm going to go through any further through this list, but they're just pointers. But I, at this point, I've really finished what I wanted to say. Just to summarise, I've talked about two strands, the parallels, the fact that there may be, you know, interesting parallels in the way these two problems, these two problem areas could be approached acceptably, and also possibly that there are some kind of cross-fertilizations between the two areas. Now I'm really interested in what you've got to say.
Let me say that the time is we have a problem with time here. Mm-hmm. So it actually is time to go up. I think we can maybe have about 5 or 10 minutes of discussion now. And mm-hmm. my suggestion would be that people who want to continue the discussion can sit together at lunch and do it over lunch. Yeah. Actually, there's a lovely place to sit. I was thinking maybe we could sit outside for lunch. I'll check it out and see whether there's benches out there. It's very close to where we're eating. It could be really nice.
Is there anywhere to work people eat?
I don't know where they've been eating. But
The red umbrella?
No, only Redwood Grove. It usually has some benches set up, which work. I'll take a look. Anyway, so 5 or 10 minutes now and then break and continue the discussion. I'm sorry, Steve.
That's okay. Well,
what time are we due back, Jack?
There's two things going on. One is at 1:15 for people who want to do it. We'll do that tour over to the view site for Odeon and down to the press where we get a chance to see the process of making Tibetan books and so on. And by the way, there's going to be some Dharma publishing books out for people to look at in the dining room today and for the next couple of days. I encourage you to buy some if you like. And then we meet back here at 2 o'clock.
Thank you.
Yeah.
See, I think it's very interesting these parallels you're drawing. And though I want to have a, to say, a rather reductive explanation of them, which is that, you know, my life's the only source of value in the world in the end is natural selection. It's the things we value are the things we have evolved to value because in the end they serve our interests as biological beings. And I mean, I've written at length about consciousness having evolved, been designed to matter to us, that it gives us a sense of our own importance and it's our own significance in the world. But that has been arranged by the process of natural selection that we cannot but think of being conscious as a good. And the threat of being a zombie is about the worst threat we could possibly have. Even, I think actually zombies it's actually incoherent, but we can kind of imagine what it might be like. And you know, I've actually worked with humans and with monkeys, which were close to being zombies. I've worked, for example, with people with blind sight, and one of the things which they find most depressing about it, particularly a woman I worked with who had cataracts since the age of 3 and her sight was still only at the age of 20, only had blind sight. She was so distressed by the lack of value of her, of coming out and seeing, that everything she'd imagined about the glories of having sight restored were just not there for her, and her response to it was to try and kill herself. So consciousness is we can't escape. It's highly latent quality. But just the same, of course, ethics. I mean, everyone says, why should we value the good rather than the bad? The answer has in the end to lie in the fact that we cannot but value those things because we've been designed through long process of natural selection to find these kinds of human relationships. Good, others bad, so it's a certain sort of behavior, and then good, others bad. In the end, I'm very much a Donetian in this sense. You could say the source of meaning is natural selection, but in a lesser way, the only sense of value can be natural selection. I was very interested in the parallel between what you're saying and Wolfgang Köller's account of what he calls requiredness, you know, his book, The Place of Value in the World of Facts. And he tries to draw exactly this parallel. He says there are certain things in nature which just have the quality of being required. But the trouble is he doesn't actually deliver. He gives lots of examples from aesthetics, from ethics, from consciousness and other things about this concept of the existence of requiredness in nature. But writing at that time without the insight which have come through later Darwin's, and he didn't have any source for requiredness in nature. But I think basically Darwin did provide that source, and we didn't find it more or less mysterious than that.
Okay, well, thanks for that. That's certainly one point of view. Yeah.
I think I want to take a little bit of exception to what Nick said. I think that the value, that a modicum of value comes from natural selection, but then because of the fact that we are rational beings, which also came from natural selection, but in, you know, for completely different reasons, you know, as Peter Singer says, you know, reason is like an escalator. You know, you take the first step and you have to go all the way. So the modicum of value that makes us respect other people is because, you know, there are relationships in our lives which are important to us and important to natural selection. We have to love ourselves, we have to love our children, we have to love our families, we have to love, you know, our people who belong to our tribe, let us say. Mm-hmm. But natural selection stops at that. And historically, you know, tribes have massacred other tribes because natural selection, you know, at that point doesn't care. In fact, it might be adaptive. But now, because we have this capacity to, you know, we have the sense of having a love or, you know, this kind of positive feelings about those who are close to us. And we have reason. And reason tells us that those other tribes or, you know, people who are not like us are actually are like us. They, I mean, on the surface, they may not be like us, but they have feelings just like us. And so once we take that step, that, you know, once we have the realization that everybody has feelings, has consciousness just like us, then we are on that escalator of reason. And that's, you know, so actually I have a graph that I draw that, okay, so this is, so on this axis is love, and on the negative axis, of course, is hate. And this is the distance of people from us. So at zero is yourself, and then your family, your kids, your spouse, your friends, and then people from your group and your tribe, let us say, and then just plain acquaintances, neutral maybe, and then you go to people that you have negative feelings for, or at least natural selection sets you up to have negative feelings for, which you might be other ethnic groups, or gays, or women, whatever, and then you know, at the far end of it is enemies. So now what natural selection has done is that it has given us something like this. You are you're neutral to your acquaintances, and something like this. So you love your family, you love your friends a little less, you love your group a little less, but at least you have positive feelings towards them. And you're neutral to a certain class of humanity that you don't know very much about, but you have negative feelings against people that, you know, you start, at this point, you start treating people as objects, as somebody to kind of exploit or, you know, increase your own happiness at the cost of theirs. And
yeah.
If you, the real, you know, moral superstars of history, they realize that, you know, has not a Jew eyes, in the sense that other people whom, you know, they would have normally hated are actually human beings. And for them, they have a different graph, which is this. So you have to treat everybody the same way as you would treat the person you love the most. And I think that this can be applied to anything. To, you know, Khalil Gibran said, what is it to build a house with love? It is to build it as though you were building it for your beloved. And so everything gets a value, you know, by the combination of emotion, which natural selection has given us, and the escalator of reason, which once you step on it, you have to go all the way, which is all of humanity. So
and then the question of the moral constituency is, where does it, you know, is extending the line, you know?
Well, actually,
there are two sources. I mean, it comes down to the very fact that there is such a category as love or loved ones, investing in evolution. I mean,
right. I agree to that. That it comes from evolution, but it comes only for those that natural selection, you know, it's advantageous for you to do it. But now, once natural selection has given us that, and natural selection has separately given us reason, because we are cognitive, you know, we make our livings by our wits, we can combine the two and we get this. And therefore, this gives us our moral imperative. And now, our duty is to kind of raise this, you know, actually, as Mazarin Banerjee, for example, has shown, we all have this somewhere. But intellectually, now, we know that this is right. So, we can raise it. So that,
yeah,
you know, we can...
And maybe lowering it this side as well, because, you know, you may need to lower it to more like that, you know, to get to be realistic.
So,
could you make a parallel diagram for and then slope the escalator?
Well, I mean, we should break.
But
I mean, the interesting thing about consciousness is that this, yeah, I mean, I think you can, yeah, yeah. Because, in fact,
this is degree of consciousness here,
yeah, we recognize, as we go along this, we find it harder to, you know, to get a kind of phenomenal, you know, empathic feeling about what it's like to be someone like, you know, at this point on the line, yeah.
I've known to go to mathematics as well. I think in Ernest, we're talking about something which originated in a commitment to human beings. And things like mathematics or aesthetics and so on have just borrowed the emotions appropriate to human contracts, and because it's so natural to humans. So when you enter, let's say, when you do mathematics, you are under an obligation to accept the consequences of certain actions. Just as in the human contract, if you get into a marriage, whatever it is,
right,
come what may, you have to take what the results of this are. That kind of commitment has been a very extraordinary turning point in human evolution. And we can commit to things like an axiomatic system. And then we find, we are obliged and required
right,
to
make
the conclusions.
Right.
We find it ugly when, you know, if somebody comes up with a contradiction or whatever.
You
notice
that Carl Grieber has this criteria for consciousness or for being aware, which is called cuddliness criteria.
Cuddliness.
Right. And he said the more the things are cuddly, more they are close to us, more we would be likely to take them in
right.
our
Right, so that is like...
So that might be like here, and
that is
how
here.
We judge the consciousness of them. Yeah.
Right, so basically the our moral imperative is to treat the ugliest person as though they were cuddly. Because...
Right.
Yeah, it's not
moral challenge is to make the line of cuddliness flat.
Right. Right.
Isn't
Kelly
the one
who's
not a show for?
Do we have a moral
So your love
was
No.
I
would not want him to die, but I wouldn't want him not to go on an easy day. So the moral imperative would be to
kill your child.
Right.
Right. Right. Right.
The moral imperative would be to restrain him and when to be in that. And that is what I have aim to work. It's in the process. The only way to do that is, you know,
to kill him. We have to be kind of collateral damage. Your intention is not to kill him. You see, I think that when the parents are actually some of the most difficult things to do, what we have to do is to be able to do it.
Right, but if you